This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, let's head out to the Hilltop Cafe. It's in Windsor Hills, an upper-middle-class African-American neighborhood in South Los Angeles, next to Baldwin Hills. Now, the Hilltop is a proudly black-owned business, and it serves avocado toast and almond milk lavender lattes. It's a kind of hip neighborhood coffee shop that real estate agents love to point out to prospective home buyers. The place is packed with an eager audience, and this evening there's a special event for the Free Black Women's Library. A lineup of 8 female poets are performing their work.
All right, I'm Bridget Bianca. I'm a poet and professor from South Central Los Angeles.
Bridget Bianca's hair is shaved close and dyed aquamarine. She's wearing a brightly colored summer dress and a gold necklace. She takes the stage with a regal confidence.
So I'm gonna give y'all a couple of poems today, and if you like them, let me know by snapping, hollering, stomping. Just don't throw nothing. You don't own this place, okay?
Like many modern-day poets, she doesn't shuffle a sheaf of papers and read from a stand. She just calls up her work on the screen of her smartphone. Reporter Courtney Kosak has been talking to Bianca about her work and life and her part in a growing local community of up-and-coming African-American writers. And today, we're going to tag along to the Hilltop for Bianca's performance. And just a warning, she uses some pretty strong language that you may find a little uncomfortable.
This first poem is called A Message for Uppity Negresses. Like me. And you too. I know what you're thinking when you see me. She thinks she all that. She thinks she too good. She forgot her place. She thinks she better than somebody. Well, the elders told me I had to be twice as good, twice as nice, twice as smart, twice as fast, twice as strong, twice as clean, twice as polite, work twice as hard to get half as much as you, and here I am. Lapping you in every race, outperforming, outlifting, outlasting, outplaying you in every match, still fighting for what you leave as table scraps in you. A pseudo-intellectual, a so-called conservative, liberal, progressive, feminist, suffragette, realist, socialist, and ally are jealous of my oppression. You. So in that poem, I go through like a list of all the things like black parents kind of tell black children to be so that they won't be mistaken for not good black people. So being clean, being strong, but also the idea of being twice as good. I don't know if other communities tell their children to be twice as good. Your sheerest victimhood to prove you too have been discriminated against. Someone once called you racist and you were aghast, you too. Have experienced sorrow and suffering, and only your brown nanny, your only your black mammy was there to kiss your boo-boo, you too. Have experienced words just as bad as nigger with the hard ER, such as mayonnaise, snowflake, paleface, and Becky, you too. Have been grappled with the burdens of history. The weight of ancestral guilt is too much to bear. You are tired of apologizing for your privilege. So that part of the poem, it does hit really hard because I think all of us kind of have that experience. It's like, you tell your friend you're having a bad day, they're like, whoa, my day was horrible. It's like, okay, well, just listen to my bad day, please. Just if you don't mind, we'll talk about your day next. And the elders taught me to be humble and keep my head down, and you never notice me, so I don't dance in the end zone. I don't beat my chest after I score. I just adore myself in the kind of things you would call tacky, ratchet, ghetto, until you manifest my destiny, repackage it to be cool, urban, tribal, ethnic. And then you tell me you didn't even notice I was black. You say. But then we work twice as hard and we are twice as good. But then we're told, no, be humble. And what does be humble look like? Not humility, actually, but just be quiet. And like, don't embarrass anybody. Just keep it down. So I want you to know, I am all that. I am too good. I know my place is first, and if you have to ask, then I have to confirm the rumors are true. I am better than you. And then the very end is always a big whoop for the audience because they realize, like, yeah, you can be confident and it is okay. Like, you're not saying, hey, I'm better than you, but maybe that is what I'm saying. Maybe that is what you're hearing. Maybe you're right if you feel that way. And so that poem kind of cycles through all these moments of what does it mean to be humble? What does it mean to be proud of who you are? And to kind of still be twice as good, which means being twice as confident sometimes too. You have to. There are so many Black writers in particular out there, and I think that we might be missing them if we only look for the folks who are already winning the awards. I think we're missing out on a wealth of folks who just don't have the access just yet. And so I know there are spaces that are very, you know, open to diversity and then everyone comes in, but there's usually just one or two folks in when it comes to entry, right? I think that we need to start seeking those voices out where they already live. And that could be like Leimert Park for me. I'm in, at the World Stage every Wednesday. And there are so many writers there who are just so incredible, who are just waiting for a shot or a chance, or maybe not waiting at all, honestly, but they're just saying, this is what I do. If you hear it, then great. But they could use that same access, right? That I have the MFA that they might not have, or that I have by working at a college, they might not have that, right? I talk about literature every day. They don't, but they still write really great stuff. So what happens? They don't get assigned, they don't get awards, they don't get book publishing deals. Like, what's going on there? I think we should put more attention in those directions and support in those directions.
That's Bridget Bianca, who performs regularly all around LA. You can find her events, by the way, online at bridgetbianca.com. And that story comes to us from reporter Courtney Kosak. Well, when it comes to literature, New York City gets a lot of attention. Here in California, it's San Francisco with the City Lights Bookstore and its connection to the Beat Writers. Remember from the 50s? Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac. Southern California doesn't quite get the credit that it deserves for its strong literary community and a great spoken word scene. But now we're going to explore that with a couple of local poets, Shonda Buchanan and Mike Songson. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thank
you.
Doing well. Shonda, I'm going to start with you because we just heard from Bridget Bianca in the last segment, reading from the message,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, how immersed in the community do you have to be to get something like that out to an audience? I mean, they were really receptive.
So it's really interesting about the Los Angeles poetry community. There are several places that we frequent, and we're also trying to bring new poets in because a lot of us have been reading for over 20 years, mm-hmm. you know, about now.
Yep.
And so I would say that the World Stage is one of the places where you can kind of cut your teeth, and where Bianca is, you know, is a member of the Anansi Writers Workshop, which happens on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. I would also say Beyond Baroque is a place where people show up and we kind of enroll or enroll you in the tribe of poets, you know, in Los Angeles. There are some other places around L.A. County, Tia Chucha, they have an open mic, Obsidian Tongues in Pomona. Mm. But I do think that we are representing and reflecting the landscape which we came from. So a lot of the World Stage was founded by Kamau Daoud and Billy Higgins. Billy Higgins, one of the most recorded jazz drummers in the world.
Ever.
Right? Ever. Exactly. Yeah. And Kamau Daoud, award-winning poet. And they founded the World Stage as a place where people could deposit their tears. But they came from the Watts Writers Workshop, which is insurrection. So the spirit of activism has always been in Los Angeles poetry. Maybe that's one of the reasons that we are not as applauded or lauded as other people, because we are very much about speaking our truth as poets. And the spoken word is welcome. You know, we love that spoken word piece as well.
It sounds very insular. It sounds like, you know, that we're more about addressing ourselves than telling the rest of the world who we are.
You know, it may have begun in a sort of insular fashion, but the poetry community could be the very most diverse scene in the city of Los Angeles. You can do poetry 7 nights a week. And prior to the birth of my daughter, I would oftentimes do 2 or 3 venues in one night.
Yes, yes.
In one night.
In
yes.
one night.
Yeah.
One of my craziest nights ever, I did a poetry event in Long Beach. Mm. I did something out in the San Fernando Valley. And at the end of the night, I did something in Pomona.
That drive.
And
wait, in one night?
In
Come on.
One night. But the community is a wonderful place. And I always talk about how I really found my identity through the poetry scene and in every different neighborhood of the city.
The tough thing that I think about when it comes to poetry, because I remember I had a journal, I wrote a lot of poetry when I was high school, college, and throughout, you know, some of the more angstful times of my life. And when you write those things down, those very, very personal things about, you know, what you're lamenting.
Yeah.
Who wants to read that in front of a crowd? I mean, that's like therapy stuff.
It's therapy, but the personal is political. I mean, Sonia Sanchez says that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were talking about mm-hmm. Jane Cortez. The personal is, again, the personal is a representation of what's happening in society and culture, right? So, I mean, just for example, I wrote my book, Who's Afraid of Black Indians, dealing with the biracial, triracial ethnicity, you know, issue. But it's personal poetry about my family, but at the same right. time, it's excavation of the free people of color in America and mixed bloods in America. And subsequently, that became my memoir, which I'm pubbing it. You know, it's coming out in August.
Yeah.
But I do think that the personal is the place where you begin as a poet, right? And so, but it's a story and it's a narrative that we're all sharing, but not everybody's writing about it. And that's why a lot of people kind of gravitate towards, you know, towards poetry as expression and towards poetry.
They say, you know, there was a number of different surveys that have said there's more people reading poetry now than ever before. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of reasons why. I think in a lot of ways, people are starving for some real meaning in the age of whatever you say, fake news and all of the different things that are happening. People want some real feeling. So a heartfelt poem, everybody, we all, every single person on this planet, if you cut them, they're going to bleed. So people can relate to these things. It may seem utterly personal, but it's really relevant to everybody. And the personal is political, and the personal is also universal when done heartfelt.
There are storytelling shows like The Moth that we carry on this radio station. I've certainly been a part of some of those. There are poetry slams. There's quote-unquote serious poetry,
yeah.
right, in other places. How do you compare those different types of places?
For me, page poetry can be performed and it can be lifted off of the page. It can be memorized. But there's also something very storytelling about it. There's a kind of a bit of a more serious air and less intonation. And for spoken word is poetry that can be said any way you want it to be said, as long as you say it in a sing-song kind of manner. And we all know that poetry. And then we like it, you know, because it's like, you know, we were like gravitating
right. we
towards it. And we're like snapping our fingers in poetry, right? And it sounds cool.
Do you guys do stuff like that, Mike?
You know, I grew up in the spoken word scene, and it was very much influenced by underground hip hop and the punk rock scene. And what was great about spoken word poetry was that it was an equal opportunity place. If you had a heart, if you were heartfelt and you were sincere, people were going to hear you. But in the 90s, there was more of this difference between spoken word and academic page poetry. And there even used to be divisions. I've written a lot about this. And they would say, is it the page or is it the stage? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of the younger generation that came up watching HBO Def Poetry Jam. Yeah. But they also wrote a lot of poetry and they had a great high school English teacher. And as time has gone on, there's less and less of a division between these two things because the word is the word.
Shonda, I want you to read a little bit.
A poem?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Read
yeah.
something of yours, because I'd love to hear some of your words. If we're talking about, you know, putting our hearts out there on public display.
Yeah. So I knew that this poem was going to be a poem that I performed often because I wanted to talk about the young African-American wrestler whose locks were cut. Because his coach said, if you don't cut your locks, you can't wrestle, basically. And his coach was a known racist, right? So I wrote this poem for Andrew Johnson. You will not die. Dear beautiful black wrestler boy, you are not the cutting of your locks. You are instead the lotus wind that escapes from slits in the laughing earth when a great tale is being told, when fault lines shift, when virgins disappear, when houses crumble to dust. You are not the scissor hands of someone you trusted yanking out your roots and branches. You are instead Hannibal's 37 elephants, 15,000 horses, 30,000 soldiers making the Alps tremble in a destined march to end an empire of tired, corrupt men. You are not the timber sound of your hair falling on a wrestling mat. You are instead the tender moment when language convinces love to come, to trust and live in a dangerous place anyway. And there's more to that poem.
That's beautiful.
And thank you so much. Thank you. There's more to it. But I really wanted to give Andrew Johnson back to himself in that poem, in the poetry. And at the end of it, I say, you are magic. You are a black boy in a field of black boys, and you are magic, right? And so I knew that that would be a poem that I would be speaking. And I have to also say, because I believe poetry is a tool to change and transform our lives. It is that ability to take a moment that was ugly and to transform it and to reclaim it and to own it myself.
Mike Songson, tell me if somebody is listening to this program right now and they're saying to themselves, him or herself, I want to do something like this. I'm really not a good writer. I'm certainly not good on stage. I get really nervous in front of people. What do you say to them? How do they articulate what is inside?
It really begins with a free write right out of your journal and not even overthinking, just letting it go. Try to, write for 20, 30 minutes and fill up the page, fill up a couple of pages.
And it doesn't have to rhyme.
It doesn't have to rhyme at all.
And it doesn't have to have like the stanzas and
it doesn't have to be
commas
formal.
Here or there.
Don't worry about that. As a young poet, don't worry about that. Get that emotion out.
Yeah.
Mike, I want you to read something as
Absolutely.
Well. What do you have?
Well, my most recent book is called Letters to My City, and I have a whole cycle of poems about all these different Los Angeles neighborhoods, and I want to do this piece. It's the first piece in my new book called I Am Still Alive in Los Angeles. I'm still alive in Los Angeles. I'm still alive in Los Angeles, even as the price of rent rises and gridlock strangles central arteries. I'm old enough to remember disco parties and the build-up to the 1984 Olympics and news reporters like Jerry Dunphy and Hal Fishman. I remember when Fernando Valenzuela was a rookie. Years before I loved Wanda Coleman and Bukowski, my first L.A. poets were Chick Hearn and Vince Scully. Then I read Mike Davis and Kerry McWilliams and watched The Gospel of Huell Hauser. Looking at things that aren't here anymore, recalling former glory like Ralph's story, I'm still exploring from Panorama City to Pomona. I'm still alive in Los Angeles as they build high-speed trains down Crenshaw and out into the San Gabriel Valley. Changes in transportation for the new generation foreshadow the nation's transformation as millennials on bicycles call for a return of the Garden City. Green in the 21st century is a matter of survival. Witness the revival of the wetlands. The riparian watershed is a sentinel for sustainability. Unbridled consumption is a liability. Observe residents of Angel City playing their part to restore nature's heart. I'm still alive in Los Angeles from festivals to funerals, baby showers to weddings. Each generation ever more beautiful. Reality is ever musical. Throngs of people mix and match, creating the patchwork mosaic of multicultural souls coming together to call L.A. home. The community is a poem in progress called Los Angeles. The angels in a city singing synchronicity from Central to Century City. Olympic was 10th Street and Pio Pico was the last governor of California when it belonged to Mexico. He was born a Spanish citizen. See the city's end soaring to Satori on a Saturday morning, circling the Evergreen Cemetery or hiking up hills in Culver City. I'm still alive in Los Angeles. As mamas monitor laundromats from Lancashire to Long Beach, I walk the long streets from Magnolia to Manchester, Rosemead to Redondo Beach. I'm still alive in Los Angeles, though there's no more open space. Most of the wetlands have been replaced by condos, Trader Joe's, and makeshift dog parks. The expanding corporate heart charts a frenzied facelift of never-ending Christmas, but only a few are on that wish list. There's a generation of kids on Snapchat, and commuters want that fast track. Alive in Los Angeles, I'm still alive in Los Angeles. Thanks to family, friends, and poetry, the past, present, and future of my city gives me energy. Untold generations of history, from Biddy Mason to Chavez Ravine to Toyo Miyataki, punctuating the power of place, turning the page, sharing authority, because we all share the story of the city unfolding. There's no hierarchy. We all belong to the city. It's oral history. I'm still alive in Los Angeles, and today I drive around L.A. with my son and daughter like I once rode with my grandfather. There's no more Perinos or the Brown Derby, but there's still Fosselman's, Kohl's, Philippe's in the pantry. My children spill ice cream in the back seat with me. Together we are alive in a city of destiny. I'm still alive in Los Angeles. I'm still alive in Los Angeles. I'm still alive in Los Angeles. L.A.
That's nice. I'm gonna snap too. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Sean W. Cannon and Mike Songson, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
By the way, you can read these poems, find a list of local readings at our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. All right, coming up, LA County supervisors are getting into the public bathroom debate. How that could change where you go to the loo. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It is something we all do once or twice, maybe several times a day, zip into a public bathroom, head into a stall, and do our business. You may not give it much thought, but for trans and gender nonconforming folks, choosing to go into the men's or women's bathroom can be one of the most stressful parts of the day. More than two-thirds of transgender or gender nonconforming people say they've been verbally harassed, denied access, even physically assaulted, trying to use a public restroom. And that's why this month, the LA County Board of Supervisors voted to expand the number of bathrooms designed to be used by everybody without regard to gender identity. Frances Anderton hosts Design and Architecture on KCRW, and she's here to talk about the implications of these new building standards. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
So let's talk about this proposal, whose proposal it is and why.
Well, this is Supervisors Sheila Kuhl and Hilda Solis. They co-authored a motion that was voted on 2 weeks ago, and this was to update building standards in county-owned buildings to assume what they're calling easily accessible all-gender restrooms, also known as unisex, mm-hmm. also known as gender-neutral. And what they want to accomplish is to have all single stall. That's like one little room yeah. with one restroom in it that you go in and you lock the door behind you. Those are typically sex segregated. You have one for men and one for women. They want all of those to become all gender or gender neutral for the reasons that you just outlined.
Obviously, changing the design of a single stall restroom, but there are a lot of things that go along with that. Like, what are we talking about here?
Well, obviously, there's certain specifics to men's and women's restrooms that we've all become used to, including men typically find a urinal. In a woman's restroom, you'll find a flush toilet. There'll be provisions for women's hygiene needs. There may be sometimes in women's restrooms provisions for nursing a child. And then, of course, there's signage. So I think everything from the signage to the plumbing is all a matter for consideration. So there'll be some plumbing questions and there'll be some signage questions. Where things are really starting to change, actually, and you may even see this happening in restaurants around town, we're starting to hear more of a kind of a new typology, which is the multi-stall all-gender bathroom. And that brings up a lot of interesting issues. Somebody who's been working very hard to make these mainstream is an architect and theorist based in New York called Joel Sanders. He's actually working on a project called Stalled. And this is what he has to say about this typology.
What we're advocating is what we refer to the European-style stall, which is almost floor-to-ceiling and affords visual and more acoustic privacy. And then what we advocate is a multi-user solution that treats the bathroom as an extension of the public space, eliminating the hallway, the doors, and having communal washing and grooming.
When we were talking about putting this together and chatting about this on the radio, in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, I mean, because it is one of those topics that elicits so many responses from so many different people.
Well, it absolutely does. And in fact, you start to think multi-use, all-gender bathroom, on the face of it, seems to make sense and it seems to solve some of these inequities, issues. But on the other hand, it raises questions. You know, women have typically used group restrooms in public places to maybe do their makeup, which they want to do privately, to maybe gossip with each other, to maybe actually take refuge from men. They even can be safe spaces. So some women feel that perhaps the all-gender bathroom might not be as safe. Single-sex, multi-stall restrooms have a place in gay history, a place for casual encounters with each other away from women. There are religious groups that do not necessarily feel so happy about the sexes mixing
And everybody, Francis, everybody has an opinion about this. The history of bathrooms, obviously, at least in modern history, in America certainly, is very complicated.
It is indeed, which is why a topic that you'd think people wouldn't want to really talk about too much, i.e. going to the restroom, actually taps into something deep in all of us.
And back to the county and what the county wants to do. How soon before they get started on this?
They want to get cracking with making all their single stall facilities all gender accessible. They want to get cracking in 6 months.
All right. Francis Anderton, obviously, hosts KCRW's DNA Tuesdays at 1:30 right here on this radio station. Francis, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve.
So here's a question for you. What are your thoughts on gender-neutral bathrooms? Tweet me at Radio Chio and hashtag at Greater LA. That's the show for today. Tomorrow, the long wait for a monumental snowmelt on the Pacific Crest Trail. Coming up next on KCRW, it's all the president's lawyers, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christian Bordahl. I'll run the operation. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Online, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Thanks for your time and for your ear. Let's do it again tomorrow.